topic for this episode of the Michigan District's Thought Leader Podcast is church governance. In this podcast, Todd Jones will provide the theoretical framework that distinguishes one governance model from another. The podcast will conclude with specific action steps you can use to evaluate and innovate your ministry's governance structure.
Welcome. I'm Todd Jones with the Michigan District of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Today we're going to talk about everyone's favorite church topic, governance. I hope you could catch the sarcasm in my voice. I suspect that I might have caused a few veterans of the ministry to break out in cold sweat as their spirits wordlessly whimpered in the dark. Governance is far from people's favorite topic, and I get it. Church governance isn't glamorous, and it's challenging and can be painful. In a healthy organization, governance is all but forgotten. However, in times of conflict, governance, particularly that which has been ignored, generally becomes the tool with which a vocal minority bends the majority to its will. So today's podcast is a challenge for you to take this time to do a quick check to see if your governance needs to be updated or upgraded. The first step in this evaluation process is to determine the type of governance your organization uses to ensure the proper coordination and management of its activities and resources. As a review, there are three conceptual approaches to congregational governance. The most familiar, which is often called congregational governance, although all three can be congregational in nature, is an approach called representational governance. Representational governance generally involves a body of elected leaders, a church council, which gathers to plan the initiatives and activities of the congregation. The church council is composed of individuals who represent specific ministries or special interests within the church. For example, the youth, the Sunday school, or the church trustees. In the representational governance framework, the bylaws are critical for detailing how the council functions and what it is to accomplish. If your congregation doesn't have a policy manual and the church council or board of directors require members at large, your congregation is probably operated from a representational form of governance. While every form of governance has its share of weaknesses, the weaknesses of the representational form of governance arise from its assumption that the church exists to meet the needs of the membership. I'm convinced that this was not the intent of those early adopters of this framework in the Missouri Synod. Likely, it was chosen because it is consistent with the democratic governance of the United States culture. Nonetheless, the representational governance almost always struggles with the need to meet the wants of the various groups within the church and a limited supply of resources to meet those needs. When one of my congregations launched a new ministry for young families, I had several older members complain, "What about us? Why doesn't the church do something for us?" Competing interests give rise to power politics, and the divisions multiply as each person feels their voice is no longer being heard. There are additional challenges with the representational form of governance. For example, getting enough qualified candidates to fill the offices and positions in the boards and committees. Second, representational governance is notorious for the number of meetings required to make one simple decision. There's also a growing disconnect between those who are doing the programs and those who are managing resources. And finally, the representational form of governance suffers from the ability of one disenfranchised member to sabotage the work of the church at large. The second approach to church governance is empowerment governance. This approach is not focused on representation, it's focused on empowering the organization to achieve its purpose. This form of governance is commonly called policy governance or policy-based governance. Just as a side note, John Carver, the pioneer of the framework, has trademarked the name policy governance. So its use is restricted to his specific model. Many congregations use a variation of Carver's model called policy-based governance. The operational principle of policy-based governance is that the organization accomplishes its mission by empowering leaders. The governing body, generally called the board or the board of directors, empowers the leader by establishing clear boundaries and measures of success. The policy-based governance is a preferred governance model for many church workers and congregations because it reduces the number of steps needed to complete a decision in the organizational process. I was consulting for a small congregation in Florida that was struggling with a dysfunctional governance model, and it illustrates the difference between the decision-making process of a representational congregation and an empowerment congregation. A youth worker who was a volunteer had built a reputation in the community for a positive impact she was having on the community's poor through an innovative youth program. As a result of the effectiveness of that program, she was approached by a car rental agency that wanted to donate one of their vans to the program. Under the representational governance, the worker needed to get approval of the church council to accept the van. She called the chairman to have the item put on the agenda for the next meeting, and at the next meeting, the item was discussed, and it was passed to the Board of Trustees so that they could determine if the church could store and maintain the van properly. Another month went by. When the council met, the trustees were asked to report, and it was reported that they didn't have enough members show up for the meeting in order to have a meeting, so they would have to wait another month. Another month passed by, and the trustees again reported they had the meeting. They assigned a subcommittee of two men who were going to investigate and write up their conclusions to present it to the trustees, and that when the trustees received that report, they would pass it on to the church council. 2 months later, the trustees presented a report to the church council indicating a plan of how they could accept the van and support and care for the van properly. The church council, having received the report, determined that there would be financial impacts on the budget, and so the plan was turned over to the Board of Finance to determine if there was room in the budget to support the van and to negotiate insurance with the insurance company. 2 months later, the church council had yet to receive a response from the Board of Finance. This was all within a period of 6 to 7 months after the initial inquiry if the church would be willing to take the van. At this point, the van had been given to another ministry. This innovative young youth worker had left the church, and this great, thriving youth ministry collapsed. The process would have been very different had it taken place through policy-based governance. When the volunteer was approached about the van, she would have had the procedures in the policy manual for accepting donations. She would have followed the procedures, probably including compiling a plan to address any legal, financial, or moral impacts of the church accepting the gift from the rental car agency. She would have met with the senior pastor to present the report, having been confident that all the critical questions were answered by the youth worker. He would have approved the plan. Within a month from the initial offer of the gift, it would have been accepted by the church. Both forms of governance offer protection to the ministry. However, the policy-based governance model allowed a much quicker response by pushing the decision-making to the lowest level possible. There is much to commend policy-based governance, but as with any human institution, it has its flaws and weaknesses. The primary weakness of policy-based governance is the board's failure to have an updated and robust policy manual. The policy manual describes the boundaries that must be monitored by the leaders and the staff as they move the congregation forward in its mission. The policy manual describes the critical targets of success for the ministry. The critical targets ensure that the investment of time and energy are consistent to the purpose for which the church was organized. Sadly, most of the churches that I've worked with, whose governance model is policy-based, lack a policy manual. It's as if they believe that by simply adopting policy-based governance, the work is done. But it's just begun. You now have to write a policy manual. Without a policy manual, policy-based governance tends to devolve in one of two ways. It becomes a representational form of governance, like a church council, only without the ability to act on decisions, or it becomes a benevolent dictatorship, with the senior pastor or the appointed leader having all power and control in the church. Now, there are several good reasons why ministries fail to have a policy manual. First, the language of the manual can be confusing. It talks about mean statements and end statements, and what's the difference and what do they mean? It can easily degenerate into prescribing activity rather than empowering ministry. And there is a level of detail that's required for good policies that can be overwhelming to many people. I'll be talking about writing good ends and means policy statements in future podcasts, so look forward to that coming out. Now, there's a third framework for church governance. It's governance by dictatorship. Now, I'm doubtful that any Lutheran congregation intentionally embraces a dictatorship approach. However, both forms of governance that have been mentioned previously, when not implemented properly, can result in dictatorship. In the representational governance framework, the dictator can be a member that manipulates the voters' assembly for their own purposes. Or it could be a pastor or leader who surrounds himself with people that will agree to anything he proposes. In the empowering framework, the leader, usually the senior pastor, may become the dictator by failing to support and educate the board properly so that it can enforce the boundaries, or by surrounding himself with people who are eager to agree to whatever he proposes. An autocratic leader or dictator can be very effective for the congregation, but puts the church in a dangerous position. Every governance system needs a process of checks and balances. In addition, by limiting the leadership opportunities of others, the dictator drives off gifted leaders from the church. And when the dictator leaves the congregation, the remaining leadership capacity of the congregation is greatly diminished. To wrap up this session, I want to present you a little bit of a to-do list. First, determine the type of governance your congregation uses to get things done. Second, once you know the type of governance system used in your church, evaluate it. So if you have a representational system of governance, answer the following questions. Are the boards or committees properly filled? If not, what strategy is needed for greater participation? Second, are there clear expectations for each board or committee? And are the expectations in alignment with the purpose of the church? If not, how can the expectations be aligned and clarified? Third, is there a clear feedback or feed-forward process between the voters, the church council, and the individual boards? If not, how can it be improved? Fourth, are the staff properly resourced and empowered? If not, how can this happen within the existing structure of the church? Now, if you have a policy-based governance system, ask the following diagnostic questions. Is your policy manual up to date and complete? If not, how can it be evaluated and updated? Second, does the board perceive itself to be representational to the congregation or empowering of the leadership? If it functions more as a representative of the congregation, what training can you use to refocus the board so that it is empowering the leadership? Third, is the pastor or key leader of the church managing the staff and volunteers in a supportive, non-directive manner so that they have the freedom to make decisions in their ministry area? If not, how can the board strengthen the leadership policies that hold the leader accountable to a collaborative, empowering ministry model? One last word and an offer. If your governance model is broken, don't try to fix it during a time of turmoil or conflict. Now, that's the time people usually realize their governance needs work. However, it's the worst time to begin tweaking with your leadership process. Nothing will intensify conflict more effectively than introducing to an anxious organization a change in leadership philosophy. Wait until your congregation is at rest when there's no conflict, when change can be introduced in a non-anxious time. If your congregation is in a time of peace and high trust, that's the perfect time to evaluate your governance system. And finally, an offer. If you'd like an outside perspective, if you want to talk more about your structure, your congregation's structure, I'm available to help pastors and congregational leaders evaluate and think through governance in their context. You can contact me via email at todd.jones@michigandistrict.org or call the office at the district, 734-213-4256. I look forward to hearing from you. God's blessings in your day.